Or
okay, I'll just check.
Yeah, check, and if not, make sure that you contact them.
Well, I don't see her here.
Michael, did you find a copy of those tests in the library?
Yes.
Were they there? Okay, were there some more?
Yeah, there was about 10.
Okay, about 10. So there's enough there, Thomas. So you take that when you get a chance and hand it in to me, okay? Now, do you remember what we were talking about? Neither do I. No, I do. Right, really. Do you remember what the three things there are to note about Greek verbs? What are the three things to note about a Greek verb? Okay, the tense, the voice, and the mood. What type of mood are you in today? Subjunctive, indicative, imperative, optative? Or good? Good mood, right? Holy Ghost mood. What are the two elements used for a verb? As far as expressing action, what two elements are involved in that? Remember that? Okay, the time of the action and the kind of action. Time relating to when it happened and kind of action, whether the action is continuous or not, so forth. What picture is involved there? Now, there are six tenses in the Greek. The present, the imperfect, the future, the aorist, the perfect, and the pluperfect. Now, we talked about the present tense, the future tense, and the imperfect tense. Now, we did not say anything about the aorist, did we?
No.
Okay, now the next tense would be the aorist tense. Should I write that down on the board? Okay, the aorist tense. The word aorist comes from a Greek word meaning indefinite. Indefinite. That's spelled A-O-R-I-S-T, indefinite. Now, what we mean by that, the aorist tense, is that it's an action completed in past time. But the stress is not on how long it took to complete the action. All the aorist tense tells you is that the action is completed. Now, with the imperfect, the stress was on the progress of the action, that the action covered a period of time, that there was action going on. Now, the aorist, all it stresses is that the action is complete. That's all. It doesn't tell you whether the action covered a split moment in time or whether it covered a long period of time. It just simply tells you the action is completed. For example, in John chapter 1, verse 11, it talks about Jesus, that he was in the world and the world was made by him. And the Bible says, he came unto his own, and his own received him not. Now, the verb received there is in the aorist tense. It just simply is indicating that he was rejected. So, his own received him not. There's no stress being put on the action of not receiving Christ. But rather, it's just simply telling you that it completed the action, his own received him not. Now, in John chapter 2 and verse 20, it talks about the temple. And there it says, this temple was built in 46 years. And the verb was built is in the aorist tense. John chapter 2, verse 20. This temple was built in 46 years. Now you'll notice something. If it was built over a period of 46 years, then it took a long period of time to build that temple. And so the context might give you the idea that the action was progressive. That is, that it covered a long period of time. But the aorist verb itself does not give you that idea. The aorist verb simply is stressing the completed action or accomplished action as a point in time or as a unit. And so this is often called, again, punctiliar. Point in time. Punctiliar, P-U-N-C-T-I-L-I-A-R. Now again, remember, that doesn't necessarily mean the action happened in just a moment of time. The action may have covered a long period of time, but from the Greek mind, it just views the action as completed, as a unit. The aorist tense. Then there is another past action tense, and that's the perfect tense. The perfect. P-E-R-F-E-C-T, the perfect tense. Now, the perfect tense, to define it for you, is an action that is completed. So it's a past action, but it's an action that's completed. But the results of the action remain right now. Remain with us right now. So the way to define it perhaps more simply would be like this. An action completed whose results remain. An action completed whose results remain. So really it has a double emphasis. It's talking about the present state resulting from a past action. And you're in this present state right now, but the present state has come from a completed past action. So an action completed whose results remain. Now the Greek perfect differs from the Greek aorist in that it emphasizes the continuing result of the action which was completed in past time. The aorist and the imperfect do not do that. The perfect does. So it talks about the completed action, and then it's stressing the result of that completed action. Let me give you some examples. When you see the perfect tense in the Greek text, normally it is very significant. It's used for the resurrection of Christ. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, let me read this to you. Chapter 15, verse 12. Now, if Christ be preached that he rose from the dead, and the Greek is the perfect tense there, how say some among you that there is no resurrection of the dead? Now, let's translate that the way the perfect would be. It would read like this. Now, if Christ be preached that he rose and remains risen from the dead. That's the idea. The action is completed. Christ rose from the dead, but the results of that action remain with us today. So there's a stress there. He has been raised, literally, and he remains risen and ever shall be risen. That's the idea. Verse 13, but if there be no resurrection of the dead, then is Christ not risen? Literally, again, then Christ has not been raised and Christ does not remain risen. See, just the opposite now. Then down in verse 14, and if Christ be not risen, there's the perfect tense, then is our preaching vain and your faith is also vain. And then it uses it again in verse 16 and again in verse 17. So all throughout, talking about the resurrection, the idea is that Christ has been raised and Christ remains risen. So a completed action, but the results of the action remain with us right now. Then let's turn to 1 John chapter 1 and verse 1 for a moment. 1 John chapter 1, verse 1. You see, this is where the King James now begins to miss some of the nuances of meaning. I mean, doesn't that add a little bit of truth to the resurrection when Paul uses more than the aorist tense? But when he uses the perfect tense that Christ has been raised from the dead and he remains risen? 1 John chapter 1, verse 1. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard. Now, the verb heard that John uses here is in the perfect tense. So you could translate it, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard and are still hearing. Which we have seen with our eyes, again, perfect tense. So we've seen with our eyes and we're still seeing. Which we have looked upon and we're still looking. And our hands have handled. And now I think that one, I'm not sure, that one may not be in the perfect tense, but the first three are in the perfect tense. Listen to Kenneth Wiest, how he translates this. He's trying to bring out the idea of the perfect. He says, quote, that which was from the beginning, that which we have heard with the present result that it is ringing in our ears, that which we have discerningly seen with our eyes, with the present result that it is in our mind's eye. See how he's trying to bring that idea out, that the action was completed, and he actually heard Jesus Christ, but the message was still ringing in his ears. The results was they were remaining with him today. So again, action completed in past time, but the results remain in the present time. Very interesting verb tense. We don't have one like this in the English. We've got to add words to qualify the verb to bring out this nuance of meaning. They don't have that same problem in the Greek. Hi. Did you get the message about your daughter?
No.
Okay, you're supposed to get a hold of the Christian school office, I think.
Oh, no.
I think so.
Can I do that right now?
Yes, I think you should do that now. Yes.
Like, when you're looking into it, then how would you know that these are aorist and perfect tense?
Well, they're all marked real clearly in the Greek, real clearly, by the verb forms that they use. And to someone that's versed in Greek, they see it, they see the verb form, and they know what's in view. But if you're not versed with Greek, then there's reference tools, which is really what we're building towards right now. Yeah, the reference tools will tell you, and they'll identify them for you. But I'm defining them for you so that when you read in the analytical and it says aorist tense, perfect tense, pluperfect, you at least have a basic idea. It's past action, the results remain, and therefore the significance of it in this verse. Let me give you another example. Luke chapter 4, verse 4. Jesus, battling the devil, spiritual warfare. And of course there the devil is trying to get him to turn the stones into bread. Well, Jesus said in Luke chapter 4, verse 4, "It has been written that man shall not live by bread alone." Now the phrase, "it has been written," it's in the perfect tense. So Christ is saying, it has been written in the past, Satan, and the results still remain today. It was written and it stands written, Satan. That's what he was saying. He doesn't just use the aorist tense or the imperfect tense. He's not just saying, well, it was written, past action, or it was being written over a period of time, imperfect. He says, perfect tense, it was written and it still stands written. And so the way you could translate it is as Weiss does, it has been written, Satan, and it's now on record that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. But with that, you know, what's the devil going to do? It's been written, and it stands written. I mean, it applies to us today. See? So it is significant when it uses these verb tenses, and you miss that in your King James Bible. Then there's a final verb tense, the pluperfect. The pluperfect. P-L-U-P-E-R-F-E-C-T, the pluperfect. Now, this is a little bit more difficult to grasp the significance of, so I'll try to bring it out to you. It presents an action as complete at a point in time, so it's a completed action verb. So it represents an action as complete at a point in time, in past time now, and as having then an existing result. Very similar to the perfect, but only the result that remains, the result doesn't remain in the present time. The result had an existing impact in earlier past action time. So let me repeat the definition here. It represents an action as complete at a point in past time and as having then an existing result in past time. So this is a double emphasis now, just like the perfect was a double emphasis. But here, the emphasis is on a past state resulting from a previous action. It's the way of thinking about it. Okay. It's a past state resulting from a previous action. Past state resulting from a previous action. And so it's very similar to the perfect, but it views the completed action from a standpoint in the past instead of the present. Now, I could chart this for you, and here's how it would look. If you looked at the perfect, let's say you have an event, something that happens in the past. Now, let's write past on here. And the action occurs, and you're standing up here. Okay? The results of that action are now with you today that happened in the past. That's the perfect. With the pluperfect, again, you have the action, which is in the past, and you're standing up here in the present, and back during this time, it had an impact, the action in the past. But the whole thing is isolated, and it's put and projected into the past, and it's not with you today. It's all in the past. So it's a past action that resulted in something in the past. See? That's the way of looking at it. Kind of difficult to grasp. Pluperfect. Not real common in the New Testament. It projects the whole act into the past. Let me give you two examples here. John chapter 4 and verse 8. John chapter 4 and verse 8. It says, "For his disciples were gone away onto the city to buy meat." Now the verb "were gone away," that's in the pluperfect. So the idea is that you translate it literally like this. His disciples had gone and were still away. And it's projecting the whole event in the past. Now the results of that action are not with us today, because the whole thing is a historical narrative. And so his disciples had gone and were still away. And while they were still away, Jesus began to talk to the woman at the well of Samaria. See? And then let's turn over to Matthew chapter 7, verse 25, and read this. Matthew 7, 25. Talks about the rain descending and the floods came and the winds blew and it beat upon that house and it fell, for it was founded upon a rock. Remember the story there? And it fell not, I should say. For it was founded upon a rock. Well, the verb phrase, it was founded, is in the pluperfect, where it says it was founded upon a rock. It was founded upon a rock. So Kenneth Weiss translates it like this. It had been built upon the rocky cliff as its foundation and was firmly established upon it and therefore blew not away. See? So it's a pluperfect. That is, it was an action in the past. The house was builded, and it was builded upon a rock, but pluperfect, it had a result of that action back in the past. It was firmly established upon the rock, and therefore blew not away. Do you see the significance there of what it is saying? Okay. Now, I need to give you a final note on these tenses. Final qualification here. Because when you read the Greek grammars, you're going to find something that could be very misleading.
I'd just like to ask you, you quote Weiss a lot. Is that a pretty good translation for
translation? I think it really is. Yeah, he tries to bring out these nuances of meaning. When he sees a perfect or a pluperfect or imperfect or aorist, he normally will translate those verb tenses accurately to bring out the meaning of them. So I think it is a very good tense. And it's an expanded translation, so he has the freedom to do that. Other translations don't have the same freedom, like even Rotherham, some of the others, they'll try to adhere to the literal text as much as possible. But because they don't have the liberty to expand the text, then therefore some of the meanings of these verbs are lost, even in something like a Rotherham. Well, when you read the Greek grammars, you're going to notice that they're going to list sub-tenses below these six basic tenses. Understand, there's only six tenses in the Greek. The present, the future, for past action, aorist imperfect, perfect, pluperfect. Well, for example, they'll list under the present tense, they'll have historical present, tendential present, static present, aoristic present. And they'll go down and they'll list all these different cases of the present tense. Understand when they do that, that is their own classifications, their own categories. It still is only the present tense. But they've got all these grammatical designations that they tack to it to classify it to the hill. And I'm sure that Peter was not looking for a historical present or tendential, or should I use a static? I think I'll use an aoristic present. Peter wasn't into that group. He was just writing as the Spirit gave inspiration. And the scholars, they can really get into this. All these different categories and classifications, and they could classify the Bible right out of the kingdom of God, I think, if you let them. But there are six major verb tenses. I'm not saying they don't have something significant to say, but really, when you study these things, your head is spinning, trying to figure out all these different sub-tenses below the regular tenses. So, number one, this is what you learn about verb tenses, or verbs, is the tense. And number two, the voice. That's what we'll look at next.
So what do you suggest then when we're using these reference material when we run it? Can't just kind of ignore all that?
Or? Well, I would say, unless you've studied, you know, Greek a fair amount and know halfway what they're talking about, just stick with the basic meanings of these verb tenses and you won't get near as confused. See, if you can use these simple definitions I've given you, and then as you read the grammars, maybe they will help amplify the definitions I've given you. So you can take what they have to say. But then when they get into all these fine little shades of classification, well then that's going to vary from scholar to scholar, from A.T. Robertson to Vincent to all these various grammarians. They're going to say, one will say it's a historical present, another will say it's a tendential, another will say, well, it's a static. Well, they're disputing amongst themselves. The main thing is a present tense, which means action in the present time. And that's the end of debate as far as I'm concerned. Let them quibble about those things. I've got other things to worry about in life. And after a while, verb tense, it becomes like a rare exotic hummingbird or something in the South Amazon jungle or something. A tendential. Could have your own little club started up just searching for these rare pieces of grammar in the Greek New Testament. Now, let's talk about the voice of Greek verbs. When we talk about the voice of a verb, voice is the form of the verb which indicates how the subject is related to the action. How the subject of the verb is related to the action of the verb. In other words, is the subject performing the action? Or is the subject receiving the action? There are certain verb forms in which action is being performed, but now the subject is receiving the action rather than performing the action. Or is the subject both performing the action and receiving the action? There are times when that will occur. The subject performs the action and in some way benefits or receives from the action. Now, in the English, we have primarily two voices. We have the active voice, which means that the subject performs the action, and we'll make the statement, I read the Bible. I'm the subject, I'm performing the action, I'm doing the reading, and so I read the Bible. How would you make that passive? Okay. The Bible is read. That's right. The Bible is read by me. To make it passive, you would say, the Bible is read by me. Now, the subject is receiving the action and not performing the action. See? So the Bible is receiving the action. The Bible is being read. It's receiving the action. That would be the passive. The Bible is read by me. Now, we also have a third voice idea called the reflexive voice. The reflexive voice, which is not real common. And here we would maybe make a statement like, I dress myself. Which means I'm performing the action, but also I'm the recipient of the action. I dress myself. I perform it and I receive it. In which the subject both performs the action and is affected by it. Now, I think when I said, I may have made a mistake when I said the Bible is read by me, the subject there would still be me, but I'm receiving the action instead of performing the action. See, it's a passive idea. So sorry about that. I hope I didn't confuse you on that. Isn't that right?
I'm confused now still.
Okay.
One is active, right? You said,
yes.
I read.
Yes.
The Bible.
Right.
The Bible is read by me. I am still reading the Bible.
But see, it's put in a passive. It's called a passive voice because now the Bible is being read by me. It's passive, and you're receiving the action of the reading.
But you're the one doing the reading, but you're receiving.
Yeah, you're receiving it. So it's reversed a little bit. Yes.
Why isn't the Bible still the subject there?
Is it?
Because it's not.
I don't know. Oh, I've taught this class probably 10 times, and I never encountered this problem now, but my mind has slipped me on that.
Would it be better?
What is it? You guys are supposed to know. You unplug this thing for about 5 minutes till we figure this out, and then we'll plug it back in. The teachers are supposed to know everything. But don't ask any questions now. Just make comments. Yes.
The Bible.
Jim, here, you're on tape. No. Relax. Quit sweating.
The Bible is the subject.
Yes.
The Bible is the subject.
Okay, yeah. That's what I thought. Yeah, that's...
Because the Bible is the
subject. Okay, my mind went a little bit haywire on me. Yeah, the Bible... That's right. Yeah. Okay, good. The Bible is the recipient of the action, yeah. Okay. So that's the difference right there. I'm sorry. We'll back up. What we're saying is that my correction needs to be corrected. I need to be corrected. I'm getting out of hand this morning. But when we say the statement passive, the Bible is read by me, the Bible is the subject, and it's receiving the action. Yeah, that's okay. We all straight now?
How many voices do we have so far?
We've had several this morning. Yeah. Yeah, right. Three. Well, the Lord will make a way through the wilderness, sister. All we have to do is follow. Now, the Greek has three voices, now that I've regained your confidence. You had no chink in your armor before, and now there's a massive hole in the side. You're wondering where we're headed. Oh, this is like Columbus sailing the ocean blue. You know, you wonder, just hope you don't drop off the edge of the world. The Greek does have three voices. It really does. Believe me, honest. Three voices. It has, for example, the active voice. And in the active voice, the subject performs the action. The active voice, the subject performs the action. For example, John chapter 12 and verse 32, Jesus said, "I will draw all men unto me." John 12:32. And the subject there is I, and I am performing the action. Okay? Now, the second one is the passive voice. Here the subject receives the action or is the recipient of the action. Passive voice. Acts chapter 22 and verse 30. Acts 22:30, talking about Paul, and it says, "He was accused by the Jews." And he is Paul. He is receiving the action. The Jews are accusing him. So again, see, now he is the recipient of the action rather than performing the action. Acts 22:30. And then there is the middle voice. And in the middle voice, the subject participates in the results of the action, or may act upon himself, for himself, or in his own interest. But in one way or another, the subject participates in the action, or acts upon himself, for himself, or in his own interest. Now understand that the subject may be affected positively or negatively. When you participate in the action, it may be for your benefit, it may be for your self-interest, but not necessarily always. The middle voice doesn't always mean necessarily self-interest. It may mean just that you are participating in the action. Let me show you what I mean. In Ephesians chapter 1, verse 10, it talks about God, that He might gather together all things in Christ. Ephesians 1:10. The Greek is literally that He might reunite for Himself under one head the all things in the Christ. And the verb gather there, it's in the middle voice for self-interest. So God is gathering all things for His own self-interest, for His own personal glory, for His own splendor, all things in Christ. Yes?
Is middle voice reflexive?
Yeah. Middle voice, is it reflexive? Well, yeah, we're kind of talking about the same idea. Were you...
Different words for this.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Now, let me give you an example of the negative usage of the middle voice. It's not always for self-interest. In Matthew chapter 27, verse 5, talks about Judas Iscariot, how he went off and he hanged himself. And the verb hanged is in the middle voice. In other words, he performed the action and he received the action, the result of that action, but it certainly was not for his self-interest. Matthew 27:5. So the main idea then in relationship to the middle voice is that the subject participates in the results of the action. Okay? So now there is one reference tool that you can consult that does mark the middle voice, and that's the Concordant Literal Translation, which covers the whole New Testament. And it has a little useful symbol marking the middle voice. And it will have like the word coming, or any particular verb. But it will have a little dot with a circle around it like that. And that's letting you know that that is now the middle voice.
What is that?
The Concordant Literal Translation. So it translates the verbs like that to tip the reader off, let the reader know that the middle voice is in view. Okay, so the way of thinking of the middle voice then is primarily the subject in one way or another participates in the action of the verb. We often, for the sake of simplicity, just say it is the voice of self-interest. Because the majority of the usage, the subject is receiving a benefit from the action. Okay, yes.
Now that, these active, passive, and reflexive, these are the Greek.
Yeah, I would say middle instead of reflexive.
Middle.
Yeah. In the English, normally, this voice that's called middle in the Greek is called reflexive in the English.
Okay.
So normally in the English you've got like active and passive, and then sometimes a third voice, often called a reflexive voice. But see, there's a little bit different in the English, because in the English you're adding a pronoun. You're saying like, I will fix a sandwich for myself. But in the Greek, they do not add the pronoun. They just use a certain verb form, which indicates middle voice, which brings out the pronoun idea.
So when we're reading, though, we probably would be able to get what verb tense it is just by reading and not even knowing, going and finding out that it was active or that it was passive or middle. Because as you're reading it, you get the sense of that, wouldn't you?
Well, kind of, but it's not always that simple, though, because some of the translations, like Rotherham now, they're adding the pronouns to try to bring out the middle voice idea. See, that's what he did in Ephesians 1:10. He added it like this. Let me read that to you again. See, it says in the King James that God might gather together all things in Christ. The verb gather there is in the middle voice, but it has the idea that he might gather for himself, for his own self-interest. So, Rotherham translates it that he might reunite for himself under one head the all things in the Christ. Now, that's a literal translation, but the pronoun for himself does not occur in the original text. So, if you're the English reader reading along, you don't know if the pronoun is there or not, or if the middle voice is being used or not. You have to almost look in either the concordant or in the analytical Greek lexicon to determine whether it is the middle voice. And they are normally marked in the analytical. Normally they will tell you it's passive or middle voice. See what I'm saying? So you can't always tell from the English what was in the Greek, because it varies from translator to translator, and you don't know what was in the original text. Yes?
Are the verb forms that they add on to the root word then to show that it is in the middle voice,
mm-hmm.
are there lots and lots of different ones? Or mm-hmm.
There are standard letters that are added to indicate these that you learn in paradigms when you study Greek. And there are certain set forms that when you see the verb in that form, you know all of a sudden now it's in the middle voice. Like, for example, if I want to say I'm loose, it's written like that. If you want to put it in the middle voice, now it's written like that. And this is the standard first person singular middle voice ending. So you can add that to virtually any verb.
Then it would show up in the transliteration as well.
Yeah, it would show up there. Yeah. But this is the word that would actually occur in the Greek tense. Text, I should say, if you wanted to put it in the middle voice, like that. See, and then you see that, and see, this right here would be in the active voice now, I loose. But now it's in the middle, or the passive, and it means I am being loosed. I am receiving the action, or in one way or another, participating in the benefits of it, or I loose myself, or something like that. So they do have regular verb endings that are marked on the verbs that tip you off and let you know that the middle or passive or active voice is in view.
Is that beyond the scope of this class?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is there, mm-hmm.
there are reference books that you can find in the library. One of them is called A Handbook on Greek Grammar, and the author's name is Mueller. And he lists all these paradigms for you. He has like the listing of the middle endings, the passive endings, the active endings. But see, these are all the endings in the indicative mood. But then there are four moods: subjunctive, imperative, optative, and then the endings change on you. So it becomes a little bit more complex. Okay, anything else here before we move on? Now, the next point, let's talk about the mood of Greek verbs. The mood of Greek verbs. Some of the older scholars call this mode rather than mood. They'll write it like this. We're talking about mood. There are actually four of them, so three things you note about a Greek verb. Number one, the tense. Number two, the voice. And then number three, the mood that the verb is in. And there are actually four of them. And I'm going to write them down and give you a brief definition with each one of them
here. The indicative. Understand now, I don't demand that you understand all the intricacies of this. Subjunctive. Imperative. And then the optative. So indicative, subjunctive, imperative, optative. Now again, see, this is a certain form that the verb will be in to indicate which mood it is in. Now this is kind of an abstract concept, the mood. But basically, when we talk about the mood of a verb, mood has to do with the manner in which a statement is made. The manner in which a statement is made. And it refers to the reality of the action of the verb. Reality of the action of the verb. In other words, is it something that has happened or is happening or will happen, and is it being stated as a fact? Is it stated as a fact, something that has happened as a fact or is happening or will happen as a fact, or is it only a probability, or is it only a possibility, or is it a command? And that's what we're talking about when we talk about the mood. Now, there is one important qualification that you need to understand when you talk about moods, and that's this. That this relationship to reality, whether it is a fact that is actually happening, or something that might probably happen, or something that could happen, or something that must happen, imperative, see, this relationship to reality is perceived in the mind of the speaker or writer, and is not necessarily the way the situation really is objectively. Someone might state something as a fact, and the speaker is speaking, but it may not really actually be a fact. So the mood represents an attitude of mind from the standpoint of the writer or the speaker. Now that you thoroughly understand that, Greek verbs are found in four different moods. The first one is the indicative mood. Spelled I-N-D-I-C-A-T-I-V-E, the indicative mood. Now, the indicative mood expresses simple declaration, simple fact. It simply views the action as a fact, whether it's past, present, or future. It just simply is stated as a fact. For example, in John chapter 1 and verse 14, it talks about the Word became flesh. Well, the verb became there is in the indicative mood, simple fact, just telling you that the Word became flesh. So when they want to state something as fact, they will put it in this indicative mood. Now, again, let me stress that it is the speaker or the writer who is perceiving the action as a fact. And sometimes the speaker will perceive something as a fact, which is really not a fact. I'll give you an example here. In John chapter 7, verse 12, John chapter 7, verse 12. There are two statements, both in the indicative mood, but they are contrary to each other. Concerning Jesus, some said, "He is a good man." And it's in the indicative mood. It's stating it as a fact. And others said, "Nay, but he deceiveth the people." That also is in the indicative mood. See? And it's being stated as a fact. So when you read about the indicative mood, or you come across this in a grammar, realize that it's being stated as a fact from the standpoint of the speaker and doesn't necessarily mean that it's an absolute fact, true, come right from the portals of heaven. See, I don't want to lead you off into that way of thinking, but it's just simply being stated as a fact. Because in John 7:12, when it says, some are saying he is a good man, others are saying he's deceiving the people, both statements are viewed as facts from the standpoint of the speaker, but obviously cannot be true objectively. You understand what I'm saying? Now, with the other three moods in the Greek, they express various degrees of unreality. Patrick.
Well, I was going to say, so all they're doing is he's just telling what the people said.
Yes.
Not necessarily what true or not.
Right.
What you said.
Yes. And they're making the statement. See, they're not saying he will probably deceive the people, which would be the subjunctive mood. And they're not saying he may possibly deceive the people, which is the optative mood. But they're stating it as a fact. He is deceiving the people. Now, whether that's true or not,
Well, you've got to read the Bible text and you've got to determine. But see, both statements are stated as statements, actual fact, because Paul is recording what they were saying. But they're not both fact. And the reason that I mention this whole thing is because if we give you the simple definition, well, the indicative always means fact, action as a fact. Well, then all of a sudden you start encountering these type of verses. Well, that's not a fact. I mean, that's not true. That's... See, it could be very confusing to you. Huh?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would be in the indicative mood, probably. Yeah. Subjunctively. It's imperative that you understand this. Indicative of a good Bible scholar.
Not optative.
Huh?
Not optative.
No, it's not optative at all. Okay, the next one is subjunctive. Would someone please steal this tape, this class? I give you permission to... I will not tell Jack Du Bois. I will buy you a banana split at Baskin and Robbins if you would... But then your other part of the mission, go back, creep back into the archives, find another tape that basically represents the same hour of teaching, and hopefully it will be a little bit more coherent. Now, the subjunctive mood is the next one, spelled S-U-B-J-U-N-C-T-I-V-E, subjunctive. In general, the subjunctive mood is the mood of probability. And it affirms that the verbal idea is not now a fact, but it may become one. So it's one step removed from reality. The verbal idea is not now a fact, but it may become one. Romans chapter 10, verse 13. The way to remember it, it is the mood of probability. Romans 10, 13, it says, "Whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved." Now, the verb "shall call" is in the subjunctive mood. Shall call. Which is simply a saying that this is not now a fact, but it may become one. See, subjunctive. Romans 10, 13. "Whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved." Shall call is in the subjunctive mood. The next one is the optative, spelled O-P-T-A-T-I-V-E, which is the mood of possibility. Mood of possibility. More remote than the subjunctive, one step further removed from reality. The action is not seen as a fact now, it's not seen as probable, but rather it's seen as being conceivable. It may happen. It's possible for it to happen. One step farther removed from reality now than the subjunctive. For example, in Luke chapter 1 and verse 62, let me read that to you. Luke 1:62, "And they made signs to his father how he would have him called." Now the verb "would have him called" here is in the optative mood. So literally, you could translate it, "how he might wish to have him called." Or "what he might wish to have him called." See, what are the possibilities, Zacharias? What would you like to call John? That's kind of the idea here. And this is the mood that is often used for wishes in the Bible, when there are wishes that are made. So it's often called the mood of hope. For example, when it says, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 23, "May he, the God of peace, sanctify you wholly." Well, that is in this optative mood there, because it is a wish being expressed from Paul's heart, the mood of hope. 1 Thessalonians 5, 23, "May he, the God of peace, sanctify you wholly." The next mood then, the final one, is the imperative. I-M-P-E-R-A-T-I-V-E. This is the mood of command or entreaty, where you are commanding someone to do something, or you are enjoining or entreating them. And here the speaker is not saying that something is in fact happening, like the indicative mood, or that it may happen, as the subjunctive mood would say, or that it could happen, the optative mood, only that he wants it to happen, or he intends it to happen, or he's commanding it to happen. So this is the mood of command now. For example, Matthew chapter 5, verse 44, Jesus, talking to the disciples, said, "Love your enemies." The verb love there, it's in the imperative mood. It's a command. No option implied now, but it's a command. And then in John chapter 6, verse 20, Jesus again talking, tells the disciples, "It is I, be not afraid." And see the verb there, "be not afraid," is in the imperative mood.
What scripture?
John 6:20. Mm-hmm. John 6:20. Okay, so those are the three things then to note about Greek verbs. Now, part of the problem that we have is if you haven't studied Greek grammar a lot, it's kind of hard to explain these things and really grasp the meaning of them. It's like telling someone how to overhaul a car engine in 2 hours, how to do it when they've never done it before. And you're explaining the parts of the engine, and they're learning these things, but they haven't really had the time to take a 2-year course on it, see? So that can be kind of difficult. I want to move on now, spend the rest of the hour talking about something a little bit different here. I want to spend some time talking about verb conjugations. Now, this is going to relate directly to your study of the New Testament. How many of you have noticed that when you open up the interlinear and you look at certain Greek verbs or nouns, and then when you looked at them in vines, they were spelled differently? And how many of you have had the experience where you looked in the interlinear and you saw a certain spelling of a word there and you tried to look it up in Thayer's? Or you looked it up in Strong's and the word was spelled differently. Have you had that problem? Okay. Well, we're going to tell you why that happens. But to do that, we've got to spend a little bit of time talking about verb conjugations. Now, in the Greek language, just like in most languages, the verbs can actually be categorized into categories showing the various forms that any one verb can take. These categories are called conjugations. And to conjugate a verb is simply to chart all the different forms it takes. Now, Tomas, if you would grab me a book back there, Dana and Matthew, the green book there, I want to show you how one verb can occur in so many different forms. This is the one standard Greek verb that you learn when you study Greek grammar. And if you look at all the various forms it can take, it looks like this. You can get an idea now of what we're looking at. 2/3 of this page, if you're listening on tape, look on page 321 in Emmanuel Grammar of the Greek New Testament, Dana and Manti. 2/3 of this sheet right here is the little verb luo, right there. These are all the different forms that will occur in the New Testament. 2/3 of it. All the standard paradigms. See, you've got different forms for the indicative mood, subjunctive mood, optative mood, imperative mood, and then you've got different forms for the 6 different tenses, and then you've got different forms for the active, middle, and passive voice. And so when you put those all together, it's a myriad of combinations. A lot of different forms. Let me give you a real simple English conjugation here. Let's take the verb to loose in the English here. And let's write this out in the active voice, present tense. And realize now we could take this and put it in all the different English tenses. And we could do it in the passive voice as well as the active. Let's take to loose. So let's write this down. This is the verb we're going to conjugate. And let's write it in the present tense and in the active voice. So those abbreviations mean. And we'll write down the singular. And then we'll write down the plural here. And what would the first person be? Anyone know? First person singular, present tense, active voice. Okay, I lose. You'd say it like this. Okay, how would you say it in the plural now? We lose. Yes. Okay, what would the second person be? Okay, you lose. How about second person plural? Okay, it would be you. Only it's understood now as plural. Now, there's no way in the English is there to indicate whether it is If you just look at this, just all by itself, there's no way to indicate singular or plural number. That's one of the fallacies of the English grammar, one of the weaknesses. In the Greek, they would have a separate verb form, a separate way of indicating you plural, loose. We don't have that in the English. How would you say it in the third person? He, she, or it, right? And you have to change the verb a little bit, don't you? You have to say he looses or she or it looses. You don't say he loose. That wouldn't make any sense. You have to add a little one letter to loose. And then how would you say it third person plural?
They.
And again, see, we don't have any way of indicating whether the they is males or females or combined group, do we? Just they, you don't know if it's masculine or feminine. In the Greek, they do. They have separate forms to indicate that. They have a separate way if they desire to. Now, let's look at one example of the Greek verb now, luo. Let's do the same thing, and I want you to see something. If we took luo, and if we did it the same way, if we put it in the present tense, in the active voice, first person, second person, third person, it looks like this. To say the same thing that you said over there, you're saying I lose with that. So this would be the singular, and this would be the plural. And to make it plural, you'd say it like this, luomen. When you see that in the Greek text, and if you can read the Greek, it says luomen, and you know right away it's saying we lose. Now for the second person, it's luace, and for the plural, it's luata. So you know instantly now the difference between you singular, one person, versus you group, luata, because they have a separate verb form. For the third person singular, it's written like this. And for the plural form, it's written like that. Now, what is the one major difference that you see when you look at these versus that over there? You're saying the same thing. Okay, the ends change. So one significant change is that the verb itself changes. Now, you can see the root of the word stays the same, which is lambda upsilon. That stays the same. But there's a little ending that's used. Now, you could take any number of Greek verbs and you could plug these endings onto them and they would follow the same endings. These are standard endings for the present tense, active voice, indicative mood. These are the standard endings. But see, when the Greek reader reads this, he knows exactly what's being said. Now, what's another thing that you see that's different? Yes.
Each one is different. There's not similar ones in any of my singular.
Right, they're all different. There's something else, though, that's different when you go from here to there. Yes?
They're all a single word.
Okay, they're one word. See, over here we have to use pronouns in the English language. There's no pronouns here because the pronoun is contained in the verb itself. And when the reader sees this, he instantly says, I lose. When he sees this, he instantly says, you lose. Because the pronoun is contained right there. Now, if the Greeks want to really emphasize this, they do have pronouns they can add. They could say, like the pronoun for I is eagle. They could say, eagle, luo. But that's emphatic now. Very strong. Now it means I, loose. It's stressed. And that's why Jesus at times did not just say, I, me, which means I am. He said, eagle, I, me, which is emphatic now. I am. He added the pronoun for stress. Now, there is method in my madness here today in writing this down, and that's this. The bell's about to ring. When you're reading along in the Kingdom Interlinear, you're liable to see any number of these verb forms. But you cannot look up any of these verb forms except for this. Because all the meanings of the words in the lexicons are listed according to the first person singular present tense active voice. And so you have to always find the root. And that's what we're going to be looking at, how to find the root. So therefore, in the lexicon, they're going to follow this omega ending, all the verbs. And you'll be reading along in the interlinear, and you might have this form, this form, this form, this form, this form. You cannot look up those words in the lexicons. They will not be there. They're not listed according to those forms. So we've got to trace it back to the root form. And there are reference works that will tell us how to do that. And all the verb forms in the lexicons and in the back of Strong's, in the back of Young's and so forth, are all listed according to the root forms. And that's why you could not look up your words when you looked in the interlinear. You did not have the root form. Okay, so more on that next week. We'll be into the actual books next week. Yes? Oh, okay. Did everyone do that? Did everyone sign the roll book twice, roll sheet twice?